You guys, it's our first new episode in a zillion years. I'm so excited to be back. And for this first episode, I'm going to be talking to somebody who wrote an article for the Washington Post that is basically the distillation of what Classical Classroom is all about. You're going to dig it. Also, another first, for the first time, I get to say, this episode of Classical Classroom is brought to you by ... because we have a sponsor. Here, let me do this all proper-like. This episode of Classical Classroom is brought to you by Maestro Classics, creators of an awesome series for kids called Stories and Music. In this series, the London Philharmonic Orchestra is accompanied by a narrator who tells stories with the music. Then there are educational tracks with a conductor and activity books that go along with it. This actually kind of sounds like something that I should get. Anyway, Maestro Classics' award-winning CDs and MP3s are loved by pretty much everybody. Parents, grandparents, teachers, kids, dogs. Okay, we can't really prove the last one, but we're pretty sure. To learn more, visit maestroclassics.com/classicalclassroom. And now, without further delay, drumroll please, enjoy the new episode. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the Classical Classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
The idea that classical music is a zone where we have to feel restricted or we have to act in a certain way, you know, that's not going to be helpful going forward.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement.
Oh, I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical music.
I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Daisha Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today is Anne Majette. She's the chief classical music critic at the Washington Post. She's the author of a number of books, including My Nine Lives, a memoir of many careers in music. Lately, she's been making waves in the classical music community with articles that have shown that the classical music world is no exception when it comes to the Me Too movement. But the reason that she's here today is to talk to me about her most recent article that's been making the rounds online. It's called A Beginner's Guide to Enjoying Classical Music, subtitle No Snobs Allowed. And she's also going to talk to me about why classical music is for everyone. Anne, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thanks for having me.
So before we jump into things, I'd like to talk about you.
Okay.
You majored in classical civilizations at Yale, which is, you know, very different from classical music. So how did you get from that point to being the classical music critic at the Post?
Although I joke it was a certain amount of preparation, since classics, like classical music, is a male-dominated field about topics that many people view as arcane. So in that sense, I was all ready to go. I majored in classical civilization because I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to take advantage of my college education to learn things that I would never be able to learn at any other time in my life. And I loved music so much already that I thought, I'm always going to learn music, and I therefore blithely did not take a single class in music while I was at Yale. I squirm now because it has a fabulous music school, and had I had any inkling of what I was going to do when I grew up, of course, I would have majored in music and lived over there. But
you were just anyway. Like, I got this.
Exactly.
I don't need schooling on that. Okay.
I listened to opera constantly. My roommates used to make fun of me as I learned ancient Greek and Latin, which, of course, I'm very happy I learned ancient Greek and Latin. As a writer, it's, you know, irreplaceable.
You were the first woman classical music critic ever at the Times. And is that ever at any of the major papers or just at the Times?
I was not the first woman.
Manuel Holterhoff. But you were the first at the Times.
At the Wall Street Journal. But I was the first at the Times. And in fact, the Times was rather embarrassed. They had never had a woman. And so the short list was all women, So I'm an affirmative action baby, you could say. I came to the Times in 2001, but it was going to be some woman if it wasn't me. It seemed an odd glass ceiling to break even in 2001. It was bizarre. I said, this has got to be a joke. Women are everywhere. Women kept coming up to me of the older generation going, you go, sister, do it for the sisterhood. And I thought, aren't we past that already? But classical music is a little bit slower than other fields. But there are plenty of wonderful female critics all around. Heidi Wailson at the Wall Street Journal. Now there are plenty of women my age and older. It's not like I was some kind of trailblazer, but because I was at the Times, it was sort of seen as a marker.
Well, you know, and I love finding out people's origin stories, like how they wound up in the careers that they're in, because inevitably, I think people who are getting started in things have this misconception that, you know, there's this clear path that you take to doing whatever it is that you're doing, especially in the classical music world.
Yes.
But they're so not. and I
totally,
you know.
Totally not.
And I think that, you know, your unusual path, your winding path to getting to where you are now and where you're firmly established and a voice that so many people listen to, may be what gives your writing such a fresh take. And, like, I love this article, The Beginner's Guide to Enjoying Classical Music, because it's so fresh. Like, most of the articles that I've read about how to get started in classical music, it's like, okay, well, you want to start with Bach, and here are the periods, you know, and like all that kind of stuff. I'm like, all right, yeah, I kind of know all that. But your article takes this really different approach. I'm just going to read the first couple of sentences because I feel like it really sets the tone for the rest of the article so well. And it starts out, "Classical music aficionados, go away. This article is not for you. Instead, it is for everyone who sees classical music as a private club and who feels they're standing outside the clubhouse. Girl, you are preaching to me."
Now, I should immediately say that there is predictably a commenter on the website, on the article, who is completely offended that I am discriminating against him with this opening, because he is an aficionado and he doesn't wish to be shut out of this article. So there's really no pleasing everybody.
No, never.
But I think it's such a shame that classical music, and I don't think I realized quite how true this was until I wrote this article, we see it as this sort of set of predetermined hurdles that you have to leap over before you're allowed to listen to any of the advanced stuff. Like, if you don't know your basic Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, and Mozart, you don't get to listen to the advanced stuff. And I literally saw somebody post on a classical music website, well, I appreciate Dara, I can't pronounce her last name, there's a female composer from 1918 from Croatia whose music I love, whom I included in this. And this writer said, I appreciate her music, but this isn't something to give to beginners. And it's like, well, why not? Music is truly for everybody. We don't have sort of entry-level versus advanced-level things in pop music, you know, when you can't listen to Björk because you haven't digested the Beatles yet. It's really equally absurd to say that you can't listen to anything in the 20th century until you've gone through your romantic composer lexicon. And it makes me see that classical music aficionados, many of them are invested in preserving this kind of perceived hierarchy and this idea that you must proceed in a certain way in order to gain admission. And that's just not true, especially in a society as musically sophisticated and literate as ours is today.
Yeah.
People don't know how to read music, perhaps, or write musical notes on paper, but people are inundated with music, and listening to music is a fundamental activity for most young people. And often they have very unique and distinctive takes on classical music, and there's a lot of stuff people would like that they don't know about.
So what made you want to write this kind of article? I mean, you've kind of gone over a few points, but was there like some particular thing that prompted you, like, okay, this needs to be written?
Well, what, you know, every few years you think about, you know, what kind of intro could I write? I know a few years ago I wrote a primer to contemporary classical music that people really like, just sort of giving a few pointers and the way into that. But I will say that for this particular introductory article, the editorial aide for classical music, who is a smart, savvy young woman, said that she herself was a little frustrated not knowing how to get further into this. And she's sitting in a position where she's got all the names, she knows all the concerts that are happening, and she's been to some concerts, and she's very eager, but she wasn't sure quite where to go. So I wrote it almost not just for her, but I wrote it for my young self because I remember being in college and loving music and yet perversely not taking any courses and desperate to gain some kind of insider knowledge status. And I wanted to get beyond the basic Bach, Brahms. I knew sort of the titles I was supposed to learn and I was learning them, but I also wanted to know more insidery stuff. And I, when I was 17, I would have really liked this article. So I think I wrote it for myself before I knew, before I lived in Europe for 12 years, before I had been through all of the different crucibles one goes through to learn things.
Well, you know, I'll go in for our listeners who don't know this. Like, the part of the reason that I started making this podcast was because, like, your assistant, I had the same experience. I was a classical music librarian at a radio station, and I went in not knowing a thing about classical music because you don't, you know, when you're a librarian, you don't necessarily need to be a subject area expert. You just need to know how to organize stuff. And so, you know, I got in there and I'm organizing these things that are completely foreign to me. And my colleagues are just speaking this language that I completely don't understand. And I have to say, to be nice to them, I think that there's a thing that happens around any kind of, it can happen around Star Trek. It can happen around like just any sort of media that people love, around which a subculture kind of develops, you know. People seek out people who like the same thing so that they can talk about the finer points of it.
Right.
And so there's that. But I got so fed up with being excluded from these conversations, not knowing what they were talking about, feeling kind of dumb, that I was finally like, okay, so teach me about it. You know, like, I don't have the knowledge to even begin with this music, so tell me what I need to know. And that's how the show got started. And it's really been such an interesting experience because there is, I think that thing that you were just talking about is sort of, it's a cloud of nothing. It's this, they create this sort of, they kind of mystify you with this fancy language. But actually, when you push through that cloud a little bit, that sort of cloud of confusing language and that seems like a barrier. In fact, there's this like lovely world of stuff that is waiting for you. And people are so happy to talk about it. And I've had such a nice experience, you know?
I'm glad it has been a nice experience once you got through the cloud. And the funny thing is why that cloud seems like such a barrier in classical music, where you think of any sports fan is also speaking a lingo. And yet that lingo tends to be less off-putting, I think, to newcomers. Like people think, oh, I want to learn that lingo. It makes you curious. And you accept that sports fans, like a football fan, is throwing around talk about downs and different kinds of plays that you're not going to understand until you get into it. But it doesn't seem as threatening somehow. And there's some reason people will come to me and say, I love music so much, but I don't know anything about it. I could never do what you do. I don't understand it.
Yeah.
And I will say, you have been subscribing for 35 years to the symphony. If you had been to the movies every Wednesday night for the last 35 years and you said to me, I don't understand film, I would laugh at you. And yet there's this sense that classical music is comprised of these exalted people who will explain it to you and clarify it to you. And to these people, I've always said, you could do what I do too if you had to. I wrote a piece when shortly after I started at the Times about being a female critic and the kinds of perceptual barriers I was still running into of, you know, that women critics were seen as being shriller and meaner than male critics for using the same kinds of language and things like that. I also would say that being a critic is a very humbling thing because you're constantly reminded of how much you don't know and of how broad and disparate this world is. And I defy anyone who works as a critic for a daily newspaper to cling to the myth that classical music is all about Brahms and Beethoven and Mozart, because you were going to be thrown so many curveballs in your working life and you're going to be exposed to so many things that you never encountered before that it behooves you to keep an open mind. And I'd like to share some of that with my readers as well, rather than pretend that there's some body of knowledge to which I have access. A lot of times readers know much more than I do about a given area.
You know, you also make this point that classical music isn't just about the composers. And I had a guest on the show once who said, classical music needs more rock stars. And I was like, I didn't really fully understand what he was saying at the point, but I kind of see that in your article, because like I've spoken to and listened to so many just amazing and interesting performers. And
right.
When you think about other kinds of music, you don't necessarily care that much who wrote the piece of music. It like the focus is so on the musicians, but in classical music, for some reason, like that's flipped. And
right.
Why is that?
Well, it's so ironic that if you get a beginner's guide to classical music, it will tell you Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Brahms, and then you go to a concert and you have no way of dealing with the performances. Just like if you read a beginner's guide to opera, it will tell you all the stories of the great operas, and then you go in and often it's being told in this wild stage direction and people have no idea why the director is suddenly set Rigoletto in Jersey City and why the Duke is singing along to a jukebox. And I think we ill-prepare newcomers to the field by downplaying the role of the performer or, in the case of opera, the director, which is very much a part of the experience of seeing music live. And let's make no mistake, hearing or seeing or experiencing a performance live is absolutely unlike getting it on recording. I mean, the recording is one thing and the live experience is another thing. And particularly when you're talking about classical music, which is acoustic instruments generally without amplification, opera is by definition without amplification unless it's a contemporary work where that's written into it. There's a visceral, physical sensation of being in the room with it that is very special. And, you know, so I can tell you all the recordings and YouTube videos to go to, but I would recommend that anybody go to some performance, any performance, and just try listening there and coexisting with the music and seeing. I think 30 years ago, if you and I were having this conversation, we would be able to name a lot more sort of minor household recognition classical music names.
Yeah.
It's been said to me that there were, you know, several dozen people who could sell out a house 30 or 40 years ago. And today it really is down to many fewer. Yo-Yo Ma, Josh Bell, maybe Renee Fleming.
Yeah.
You know, it's a smaller club. That's partly because I think the template of big old-style classical music is kind of fading. And I think that's a really great thing. I think that classical music is heading toward a more creative, DIY, smaller groups, more interesting kinds of performances future, which can only help the field. I mean, it's a shame that the field is seen as being in decline and so forbidding, but I think in part this is because a lot of the big institutions that are off-putting to people are crumbling a little bit. And I think what will replace them are things that's more about the actual music. You know, I always say classical music is not in trouble. You're going to be hearing Bach and Beethoven and Mozart. They're all doing fine. What we say is in trouble right now are the institutions of classical music, and maybe it's time for a little bit of a renewal there. Don't make the mistake of conflating your local orchestra with classical music in general. Just think of the orchestra as one way that you can get this music, but there's a bunch of ways you can get it, and there's a bunch of different kinds of performances you can see to experience it.
You know, it's interesting because that kind of change has been happening in other musical genres for a really long time. Like, for example, in the rock music world, the breakdown of the record label as the big kahuna.
Right.
You know, so it's interesting to see that that's happening in the classical music world as well. All right, so let's take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of my conversation with Anne Majette. Seen the new Classical Classroom website? It's at classicalclassroomshow.com, and our friends at New Y made it. If you want a website as cool as ours, or you want the world to know about your widget company, go to classicalclassroomshow.com/NW. That's N as in new and W as in Y. Okay, now back to my interview with Washington Post classical music critic Anne Majette about her article, A Beginner's Guide to Enjoying Classical Music, No Snobs Allowed. So we were talking about how traditional classical music institutions are changing and how new, more non-traditional ways of doing things are beginning to emerge. And your own story is actually evidence of that. So how did you get into being a classical music critic?
After I graduated, I went to Europe to be a writer, and I wanted to live in either Germany or Italy because there was lots of opera there, and opera was my thing, and I wanted to write a great novel. I began editing a monthly magazine for English language residents of Munich, which was put out by a woman who happened to live in Munich, and her husband happened to be a music critic of Time magazine. Opera News bought an article of mine out of that magazine. This is a very improbable story. And then they assigned me an article, and then they called me into their office when I was in New York the next time and said, we're going to make you our reviewer for Germany and Austria. And I said, well, I can write about the arts. I love the arts, but I can't be a critic. I said, I don't have the background, I don't have the knowledge, and I don't have the desire to be a critic, because I thought, as many people think, that critics are nasty people who say bad things about artists. And my entire family were artists, so I had particular reason to think that critics were awful. To which the editor of Opera News replied, you'll learn, and sent me out to review the world premiere of Karlheinz Stockhausen's opera Dienstag from his seven-part Licht cycle, as the first ever review I ever wrote of anything musical, paired with a review of Rameau's Hippolyte et Aricie.
What?
That is some confusing classical music terminology.
What you talking about, lady?
And throw to our resident confusing classical music terminology explainer, Keith Weber.
What Anne is referring to here is the work of the great German theorist, experimental musician, and composer Karlheinz Stockhausen. Was born in the 1920s and lived all the way to 2007. A man who was known for busting through barriers and rules one after the other. And so this piece was translated means Tuesday from Light, the German title Dienstag aus Licht. That's the piece she's referring to. The premiere of that part of it eventually became a big operatic cycle called Licht, die sieben Tage der Woche, or Light, the 7 days of the week, a cycle about life itself. And then the piece she's referring to here is hundreds of years earlier than the Stockhausen, but also written by a rule-breaking trailblazer. His name is Jean-Philippe Rameau, and Hippolyte et Aricie was based on a Racine tragedy called Phèdre. In fact, it was the form of opera at the time. It was called a tragedy in music, but he wrote something so extravagant that people had even trouble playing it, much less understanding it. Quite a remarkable piece. You know, and both of those pieces that she just mentioned were insane things to start your career in criticism. It's like climbing Mount Everest on your first hike.
Okay.
And I had a minor panic attack during the press conference in the Leipzig Opera, but I did write the review, and the rest is history. I became a critic.
And voila, here you are.
And voila, here I am, exactly. I mean, there's a reason I tell that story. I was a smart person. I could write, and I loved music, and I had never encountered a Stockhausen opera before, but I wrote about the experience, and I can't say it was the best review in the world, but that description has some quality to it that conveys something about the experience of somebody else. And it's up to you as a writer to figure out what that experience is.
Yeah.
So I'll say to people, you could do exactly what I do. You have advanced degrees. You've subscribed to music for years. Well, one person took me up on it. And I have a reader, I think it might be even 7 years now. Every Friday, he writes to me about what he thought of the National Symphony Orchestra concert the night before. Mm-hmm. And now it's become a thing for him. But he began sort of tentatively, and he's become much more opinionated, and he's thrilled when we disagree. And, you know, I don't always have time to answer him. But, of course, we've become very friendly over the years. But he used to write a sort of year-end summation every year, and he'd always say, I never enjoyed my subscription so much. And this is a lovely and funny and kind of tragic story, because this man is now in his 80s, and it took me coming along to give him permission to have his own opinions about this thing that he loves and is knowledgeable about. And so I don't think it's just a problem with, you know, 25-year-old newcomers to the field. I think it's a problem with 75-year-olds who have been going every week, that somehow they don't think they're allowed to say what they like or don't. This is not true of everybody. I do have very opinionated readers as well, but I don't think it's as uncommon as one thinks. And there's a kind of, you have to be a member of the priesthood in a way to have the privilege of explaining this. This is why I brought up the female critic thing, because maybe it takes a woman critic to sort of challenge the priesthood a little bit, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And well, you know, but I love what you say in your article to this exact point. This is one of my favorite things in this article. And the point, the sort of major point is classical music can do things that no other music can. And within this point, you encourage people to kind of look at classical music like a novel. You say you have to meet it halfway and think about what it is or isn't saying to you, listening to different sounds it offers, recognizing the reemergences of earlier themes, etc. And then you also say, comparing and contrasting and debating preferences is a big part of any musical lover's experience. As soon as you're comfortable enough to do that in classical music, to notice that you liked one piece, one approach or one performer more than another, you've taken a big step toward making it your own. I just love that concept that, like, there's not a special language that you need to know.
Absolutely.
Because I personally, I'm never going to have that language. Right. and, like, I don't really care to either.
Yep.
And because it's not my language. And when I listen to this music, I experience, just like when I listen to any other music, I experience something different than anyone else does.
Right.
And I like that you're kind of giving people that permission that you were talking about in this article and telling them, look, this, you just approach this like any other art, where you're like, gosh, what do I think about this? How do I feel about this? This is how you make a thing your own.
I think it's so important. It can't be said enough. And there's something kind of sad that I think people go to classical concerts with a lot of anxiety. How am I supposed to behave? What am I supposed to be getting out of this? And I've taken a lot of first-time opera goers to opera, or sent first-time opera goers to opera. And I'll say, just tell me whose voice you liked better. Like, don't worry about what you're supposed to think. And almost always, those novice opera goers, they hear exactly what's going on. They hear whose voice is good and whose voice is bad. For goodness sakes, most of us have been listening to vocal music all our lives in the form of rock bands or pop bands, whatever kind of music you like. We listen to vocalists. And it's usually the people who know a little more about opera who just get completely tongue-tied and are unable to give their opinion at all.
I want to know, like, so we're talking about this lovely thing where it's like classical music is like any other art form, and really all you need to be is curious and ask questions and pay attention to how you're reacting to it, all that kind of stuff that any human person can do if you're lucky enough to have the ability to hear.
Right.
And so where do you think that classical music elitism has its roots? It's like this music used to be the music of the people. Everybody went to concerts. So where did things go sideways? When did this very strong club that has its roots, it's like, it's not just, it is this sort of perceptual thing where it is that cloud of unknowing that they create, but it's also more than that. It's about money. It's about the people who control what rep you hear when you go to a symphony. It's all that stuff.
Well, let's remember that actually in Beethoven's day in Vienna, it wasn't quite music of the people. In fact, when you read accounts, eyewitness accounts of Beethoven's day, you hear a lot of hand-wringing about the terrible, depraved taste of the people and how nobody goes to chamber music concerts and nobody knows what really good music is, and they're all listening to this crap. The crap they're listening to is Rossini, you know, but Beethoven is much more exalted than that. And also, classical music used to be much rarer. There weren't as many concerts. There weren't recordings. It was music of the people because you could play it at home. More people had keyboards and you would buy the music and you would play it. But going to a concert has been an elite thing. You know, it's associated with wealthy patrons and aristocrats. And then you get into the 19th century and you get big opera houses where everybody buys a box and people would go to the opera to see and be seen, and people would talk all the way through. I mean, opera in Italy in the 19th century was like a baseball game. There were people selling food in the aisles and people talking. And sometimes you'd stop and actually hear the music. And that was how you knew you had a real hit, if people listened to the aria. I don't think it's that it wasn't for the masses quite, but it had a popular appeal. It was the main form. Certainly opera was the main form of popular entertainment in Italy in that era. It played the role that film plays now. And I think that's where you see the biggest shift is in opera. Now the operas that we regard as high elite art were back then much more things you would hum in the street. But there's always been this intertwining of elitism and wealth and art, because the artists have gone to the people who could pay for it, whether they're visual artists or musicians. The issue today, I think, has become with trying to democratize it, trying to bring it, to make it fair for the musicians. I mean, until the 1960s, we think that orchestras have been the way they've been for a long time and are now declining a little bit. But in fact, the orchestra as we know it today in America really grew up in the 1970s. In the 1960s and 50s and before that, certainly many, even major orchestras, were only part-time gigs, and people would work in grocery stores part of the year and then come and play in the orchestra for the rest of the year. It was not at all a full-time, year-round, secure position. And musicians who went on tour would be taken on tour for 2 months and stuck in buses and living in terrible conditions and no restriction on how much you could travel and play. So the relatively cushy year-round season with union contracts and benefits and guarantees is all relatively recent and is proving now very expensive to continue. So that's a little background to the overview of music and money. It takes a lot of money to keep this stuff going. You need a lot of patrons. The government is not putting masses of money into music, except in the sense that they give tax write-offs to people who donate.
Yeah.
And those tickets are not cheap, even though any orchestra or opera house only pays for a fraction of its operation through ticket sales. They still jack up the ticket prices. However, I think all of that said, the perception that music is a thing for the elite in America today is partly a perceptual issue, because if you look at ticket prices, yes, the highest ticket is often a few hundred dollars. The lowest ticket is usually, there's usually something in the $15 to $25 range, which is within shouting distance of a movie. I think that a lot of presentations are within shouting distance of the theater. Broadway is much more expensive than a lot of opera productions, and you don't hear the same scream about Broadway because it's an iconic thing to do.
That's very true.
And certainly pop concerts or even going to hear some singer-songwriter that you like. If you spend an evening out at a club and get entry tickets and then a couple of drinks, you're going to end up spending maybe $100. So in that sense, it's not priced so completely out of reach.
Yeah. I mean, I've yet to be able to afford to see Justin Timberlake. I feel like this is never going to happen for me. Yeah.
So I think classical music isn't the only entertainment that's expensive, but it's become so much seen that way. And also the people are thrilled to give the money to hear Justin Timberlake. People aren't sure they want to give that money to the orchestra. They're not sure they're going to have an experience they like. And so it seems more expensive, you know, to buy something you don't know you're going to like. Of course, there's more of a barrier to giving out that money.
But it is interesting, you know, that people have that perception, because you're right. Like if you look hard enough, you know, you poke through the ticket prices at your local symphony's website, you can usually find something that you can afford. But yeah.
Yes, and there's often discounts. I think part of the problem too is that the experience that is being marketed is not inherently appealing to people, because the experience is you are going to go and sit in silence for 2 hours on velvet seats. You're not exactly comfortable. You're not sure what to wear. You're not sure when to clap. You don't know what you're supposed to be getting out of it. Why on earth would you want to pay for that experience? And it's too bad, I think, that orchestras have become so... We're talking about orchestras in particular because, of course, chamber music is much more flexible. I mean, classical music can be a solo piano doing something, you know, but an orchestra is a particular, or an opera is a particular size. And orchestras are trying to break down that perception, but I think it's a shame they don't do it more. It's possible to perform in different kinds of venues.
Yeah. You know, when you're speaking of classical music, offering something on a large scale, I'm wondering if you could recommend a couple of pieces of music that people could get started on to listen to at home, maybe find on Spotify or whatever, to listen to with regards to orchestra music.
Well, I assume that anybody who's heard of an orchestra has heard of Beethoven and Brahms. And of course, listening to a Beethoven symphony is never a waste of time. I love Beethoven's Third. But I wonder if people know how much more recently has been done. I heard Philip Glass's Fifth Symphony recently, and I just loved Philip Glass's Fifth Symphony. It it's massive, it's huge, it's enormous, it's ambitious, mm-hmm. and it's in a different idiom, but it comes directly out of classical music. It's not off-putting at all, to me. And, so there's one.
Wait a minute. I think the repetitiveness of Philip Glass, I think, gets to people a lot, and that's what they think about him for, but from what I understand, and I need to listen to more of this because I don't actually know, kind of talking out of my butt right now, but I hear that his more recent stuff is not so much like that. Like, he's taken it in different directions. Is that true?
It's true. I think Philip Glass has forged for himself a distinctive vocabulary that is mm-hmm. based on a slightly different building block than the Romantic Symphony. The Romantic mm-hmm. Symphony, we think about nodules of melody. With Philip Glass, yeah. you have little nodules of sort of repeating things. Mm-hmm. But they're as easy to recognize as melody, and he uses them in very similar ways. So his symphony is put together out of these big blocks of musical event, but he uses those blocks to create tremendous drama. I don't think you listen to the Fifth Symphony and find it that repetitive at all. So in that sense, yes, you could say he's no longer so repetitive. There's an unmistakable thumbprint there. I think that his Songs and Poems for Solo Cello, to me, is a piece that should make a Philip Glass convert of many people. It's a very beautiful work for solo cello on a small scale. Again, it's for one instrument. But those are places that you can start, or say William Grant Still's Afro-American Symphony. It was his first symphony. William Grant Still was an African-American composer, mid-20th century, who had to contend with a lot of prejudice. When you listen to the African-American Symphony, you are surprised with how much it presages George Gershwin. Can tell that Gershwin was probably listening to this. And again, mm-hmm. Gershwin is a figure who I think has filtered into the vernacular sufficiently, at the very least through advertising, that people have a little bit of a sound in their mind when they think of Gershwin.
Yeah.
So William Grant Still is somebody you could listen to with a lot of interest for that.
Cool. I'm going to check that out.
And then there's people like Alberto Casella, who's an Italian sort of forgotten Italian of the early 20th century that the National Symphony Orchestra's current music director, Gian Andrea Noseda, has been championing a lot. And to hear this music just makes you realize how much there is out there that even aficionados don't really know, that is really well worth hearing. There are whole literatures that people don't know about sufficiently. That said, if you are somebody who kind of wants to work your chops up, then I would say also listen to the Mahler Second. Or Bruckner's Seventh Symphony. Interestingly, Anton Bruckner, who was an Austrian symphonist for the late 19th century, has much in common with Philip Glass. People call him a proto-minimalist. What I said before about assembling big blocks of sound, Bruckner does that too. He's kind of almost clumsy in the way he puts together his works, and he creates, they're always called these cathedrals of sound, these great big monumental symphonies that are kind of craggy. And it's not dissimilar from the way minimalists structure their music. The Seventh Symphony is well worth a listen.
So, those are fantastic recommendations, all of which I want to go listen to right now. But I'm also interested in this other point that you bring up, which is classical music is relaxing. Sorry, let me say that sentence again. Classical music is relaxing. So, and you follow that sentence up by saying that you don't agree with it, which you kind of have to do because people in the classical music world, I've found, take offense to calling their music relaxing. You know, you're talking to a classical musician and you're like, this is not relaxing. This is, you know, and they go on for ages about how, you know, how much is in the music. But you go ahead and say this. So why are you saying this?
Because, as I said in the article, I think a solid 75%, if not more, of my non-classical music aficionado friends listen to classical music for relaxation. Classical music is often thought of as background music. It's something you put on during brunch and whatever. Those are functions that it can fulfill. It's certainly often we hear it in the elevator, you know? And that's a legitimate use for it, even if it's not one I can relate to. I have trouble concentrating when there's music in the background, which is maybe a lack for me. But I certainly am happy to recommend some tracks. I recommended, for example, the piano pieces of Erik Satie. Which I confess I did listen to for a couple of years. We called my then boyfriend and I called it morning music. It was sort of all I could take in the morning, the sort of quiet, wispy, slightly tangy, cigarette smoky trails of Gallic piano music and these deceptively simplistic rocking rhythms. It's wonderful stuff.
Yeah, I know. I actually know this music.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's good stuff.
And I mean, I said the Bach solo cello suites because really, those are things to take with you through your life, whatever function you want them to have. They're sort of iconic pieces of music. Again, most everybody probably has actually heard a bit of one. It's not a bad place to start if you're looking for some good classical piece to carry with you. And then I mentioned in that article, Lou Harrison's Concerto for Violin and American Gamelan. And this is an example of the kind of thing you don't know when you want to become a young classical music critic and you listen to a lot of Bach and Beethoven. The gamelan is an Indonesian ensemble of percussion instruments, metallic percussion instruments. And Lou Harrison, a 20th century American composer, built his own equivalent of a gamelan, which is why it's called American gamelan. It's also based on sort of xylophone-like instruments that you strike, but it was made from, I believe, found objects and has a slightly different timbre. And he puts that together with the violin. And that's a sound world that you don't often find in classical music or other music. It's a very distinctive kind of wonderful sound. I'm on a big Lou Harrison kick at the moment. There's a kind of wonderful direct clarity to his music. I think there's a lot to be had from listening to Lou Harrison.
So I love that you've written this article, and I really hope that it speaks to a lot of people and people begin to feel more invited into this world. That's certainly my MO in doing this show. But I'm wondering why you think it's important for this to be remedied, for people to begin to feel invited into this world. Why do you think that it's important for this music to persist?
I think it's great music. I think all great music should persist. I think it's really unfortunate that this music is segregated in the minds of many of its supporters, as well as its detractors is the wrong word, but as well as people who don't yet love it. I think people try to propagate the idea that this music is better and better for you, and it will make you a better person, it'll make you smarter, and just look, they can play it, and, you know, inner city school children will have better test scores if they play this music. And I think that only by coming on the same playing field as the rest of the world does this music really have a chance. And I think it can hold its own. It's already shown it can hold its own. I think that misplaced elitism does nobody any favors. But certainly, I mean, I love this music with my whole heart. That's why I ended up writing about it, and it's become my whole life to a degree I never would have imagined. So I do think it's worth commenting on. And I think that important art is always worth thinking about and talking about. And we're fortunate enough still to have a place in the mass media to do that. You know, mass media itself is dwindling a little bit, and the role of a critic is constantly being questioned. But the bottom line is that we do this in order to remember other sides of the human spirit. And that's something that's worth thinking about and worth having people know about.
Fantastic. Anne Majette, thank you so much for being on The Classical Classroom. This has been an incredible discussion. I've kept you going for like 50% longer than I told you we would talk, but it's been so interesting.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure, and I didn't notice the time, so.
Oh, okay, great. Yay. I'm glad you had a good time, too, then. All right, everybody, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to classicalclassroomshow.com. You can find everything you ever wanted to know about the show and more there, including ways to connect with us online. You can email us at classicalclassroomshow@gmail.com. Classical Classroom is produced at King FM, our new home, where they've loved us and squeezed us and named us George. Thanks to our birthplace, Houston Public Media. Thanks to Anne Majette for being on the show. Thanks to Lenny's Limo Lounge for providing limousine services. Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.